All right, friends, our turn. Greg Kokel here. There goes that mic again. All right, I'm changing to this mic. We got a bad connection on one of these mics. Every time I touch it, it goes a little silly. So, and I can't keep from touching my mic. It just, you know, move it around, bang it, you hit it while you're getting histrionical. Anyway, glad to have you with me on our show, Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason. And, man, I'm still a little bit high from last weekend. Our annual Rethink in Southern California, Calvary Chapel, last count, 1,805 people. Wow. That's our biggest Rethink ever. 1,805. Now, we didn't go actually fully to capacity, but we were just about there. I mean, when I was sitting in the front row at the opening session on Friday night, and I looked behind me, that auditorium just seemed chock full. There were no empty seats. We had to guard ours in the front row for me and my family because when the kids were let in, the young people, they just charged for the front. They were so thrilled to be there. And I'm just thrilled for how that all came down. It was magnificent. It was so great. And if you missed it, well, you know, we still got two more coming up. And they're in the spring, one in Dallas, I think. I can't remember which one's March and which one's April. But one's in Dallas, and another one's in Birmingham, Alabama. And last year we had 1,600 show up for that, our very first one in Birmingham. And it's hard to know which of the talks or the breakout sessions was the best. I was compelled by virtually everything that was said and done. Christopher Yuan gave his testimony, talked about how God had rescued him not just from homosexuality but also from prison. And the radical change that was brought in his life because his mom prayed for him so much. It was an absolutely riveting testimony. And we're going to have Christopher back, of course. And we finished off on Saturday afternoon, the last plenary session, J. Warner Wallace, with a charge and a challenge that was, man, I will tell you quite candidly, that I was so moved by J. Warner Wallace's challenge that I broke into tears. My wife had to comfort me, but it wasn't tears of anguish. They were, I couldn't say tears of joy either, but they were, it was just an emotional moment. What he said was so powerful. And one of the things that he said, and there were lots of them, as he brought this whole weekend to a head and a challenge for the students not just to sit in a conference and learn and hear and not be changed and not do something, but go out and act. And as he pointed out, and he's done this many times, we don't need any more million-dollar apologists. We need a million $1 apologists. And that was everybody there in that auditorium, just about. So it was powerful. But he made an illustration, or he made a point, and he illustrated it from his detective work days that I'd never heard him make before, and it moved me to action. And what he said was when he began a new case, usually, of course, he was a cold case detective. That means these were cases that had been pursued and were unable to be solved many years ago. And they sat on the shelf in a big red folder, all the information, all the sheets of paper, all of the records there in a big giant binder, and there they sat cold until if and when somebody was able to solve the crime. And these were the folders that Jim went to, and it was a big giant thing, sometimes 4 or 5 inches high with all this documentation. Of course, the evidence related to it was in a different place, but this was the paperwork And he said, you know, before we ever started any case, reopened a case, I started from the beginning and I read through the entire folder, hundreds and hundreds, and in many cases, hundreds of pages of stuff. And he said, you know, this was all the information related to the case. This was everything that we had pertaining to the homicide. And if he was going to solve it, he was going to solve it from inside the covers of this notebook. That's where the information was, to see something that had been overlooked. But he had to go through the whole thing to get the big picture, to be able to do the job. And he said, you know, sometimes these things weren't in the right chronological order. Other times there were information there that he didn't understand. Sometimes it was just plain old boring. But the truth was in there. He just had to go through it and parse it out and find the things that were overlooked so he could finally solve the crime. And so first order was to read from beginning to end, from start to finish, through the confusing parts, through the boring parts, through the parts that weren't necessarily in chronological order, just to get the grasp of the whole thing. And it wasn't until he got the whole thing that he could start working on the parts. Now, some of you know where I'm going with this, or where Jim was going with this. He said the same thing is true of the book, the Bible. There it is. I got one right in front of me, a thick one. Start to finish. He's challenging the students and the adults and even me. I've read the Bible through a number of times, but it's been a long time since I did it. And sometimes my Bible reading is here and there and a little bit in the morning, and then a couple days later a little bit more. You know, I'm traveling or I'm busy or whatever. You know how it is. You do. It's the same for us. And I decided that, gee, I'm going to get down to it, and I'm going to work through the whole book again from beginning to end. And he said, he told the students, don't come back to rethink next year unless you read the whole thing. Of course, we want you back, even if you didn't, but you get the point. It was a challenge. It was a charge. Get out there, read it, get familiar with it, get the whole thing. Even if you don't understand some parts, even if some parts are boring, even if it's not all in chronological order, just start at the beginning and go to the end. And by golly, I took that to heart because I was challenged by Jay Warner. So I went to online and I checked out, and I had done some of this before. Discipleship Journal has a daily breakdown, so you read through the Bible in a year, and it's like 6 days a week, actually. So you got a day of grace in case you fall behind, that kind of thing. And as it turned out, last time I did this, it took me more than a year. But I just kept picking up where I left off, regardless of what day it happened to be on the calendar. I just picked up where I left off and worked through it. And there are different ways to do this. You can do this by books, or you can do this by little pieces across the broader spectrum, Psalms, the law, I mean, the law, wisdom, literature, the prophets, the New Testament, Acts, or something like that. You know, a little bit here and there. There's lots of ways to do it. In fact, I went to the Gospel Coalition website, and under the heading of Bible reading plans, there was a whole blog with lots of different plans you could link to. There were probably 7 or 8 different ways of going through it with PDF files you could print out and fold over, put in your Bible, and use that with the checkoff boxes so you can do it. And so I started yesterday, and I did my daily reading in Genesis, and then and the Psalms, and then today I picked up a few more chapters in Genesis and another Psalm, and I'm just following it through. So it was a good challenge for me, and I hope there are a whole lot of people in the gallery that took that challenge personally, that said, you know, I've never done this before, but by golly, I'm going to. And by the next time I come to rethink, I'm going to have been through the whole Bible, or pretty much most of it. And that's my goal as well. Now, what happens when you do that is you get a, you'll be amazed at how many times you read something in a given day and something pertaining to what you read is going to come up. It happens to me all the time. In your conversation with other people, in a circumstance that you're facing, that you need some wisdom or insight or guidance from the Word, it turns out that guidance is going to have been in your reading for that day or maybe the day before. And some might call it a coincidence, but when I stop reading, the coincidences stop happening. It's just what happens when you walk with the Lord and are regular in His Word. And it, in so doing, you get the full counsel of God over the year. Now, when I started in Genesis 1 and 2 yesterday, and then 3, 4, and 5 today, I read slowly and deliberately, paying attention to the words. And I've just got to tell you, especially Genesis 1, I've read this that chapter a whole bunch of times, a lot more than other parts of Genesis. But there were so many things that stood out for me going slowly and deliberately through these chapters that I had never seen before. Now, sometimes there were questions. Now, why is it that this was worded in that particular way rather than some other way? And what did he mean here? But I'll tell you one thing that jumped out at me, again, that I had not noticed. It was in Genesis chapter 2 yesterday and then in chapter 5 today. I know there's a lot of fuss about what the word day means in Genesis, whether it's a solar day or whether it's a longer period of time. And by the way, just determining that isn't going to resolve your questions about how to understand Genesis 1, because it could be. When I say, look at honey, you are a breath of fresh air, or something like that to my wife, or you are a ray of sunshine, you realize that I have to mean the phrase ray of sunshine in its literal sense before it can be leveraged into a metaphoric use. So whether day is a 24-hour day, if that's the way the word is used, still doesn't answer the question as to whether it's being leveraged for metaphorical purpose, all right? Just an aside there. But I thought it was interesting when I read chapter 2 of Genesis in verse 4, it says this, "This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven." Well, of course, according to Genesis 1, it isn't in a day that he made them. It's in 6 days, however you understand that word, that he made it. And here the word day is used to describe the entire series in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. So clearly there is a flexible use of the word day right here in the first two chapters of Genesis. I don't know if that's going to change your theology or not, but I just want you to think about that. But this morning I read Genesis 3, 4, and 5, and in the beginning of chapter 5 I saw something else. This is the book of the generations of Adam. This is the first verse. In the day, same language, chapter 2, right? In the day when God created man. Wait a minute. It's one thing to say in the day that God created the heavens and the earth, because we know the days were, there were 6 days that he created, so that phraseology of day in verse 4 of chapter 2 is referring to the whole creation, quote-unquote, week. But here it's talking about a detail of the creation week, something that happened on the 6th, quote-unquote, day, the creation of human beings. And the way the text is phrased, in the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Notice it doesn't say on the day. Now, that may not mean anything. But when you do something on a particular day, you say on that day. And you only use the phrase in the day when you're talking about a larger period of time. So on Wednesday, I did this. But in my 27th year of life, I had these experiences, or this happened to me, or something in that, in the 20th century. So when we say in, we are usually referring to a larger period of time. And it seems like it's saying that there is a larger period of time that entailed the creating of man. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness according to his image, and he named him Seth. So that's the first three verses of chapter 5. I don't know. I'd never noticed that before. Here I am now reading carefully because I'm devoted to going through the whole Bible again in a year or something close to that. And now I have a guide, my Bible reading plan, and focusing more now on it, I learned some new things, or at least have some new things to think about. And I suspect you will, too, if you do the same. The Gospel Coalition, the title of that blog is Bible Reading Plans, so should be easy to Google. And you can select your own plan there and go through your own Bible and be fed. All right, let's take a break. And I got a whole bank of callers on, and I want to get to you shortly when I return on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come and speak at a location near you? Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To schedule Greg, Alan, or Tim, send an email to Melinda or Darcy. To learn more, visit str.org/training/speakers.
Do you want to become a more skilled and knowledgeable Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscribe at the top. When you do, you'll get your pick of 6 great online publications from Greg, Alan, and Tim. And these are no ordinary newsletters. They come loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, and STR E-News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Alan and Tim. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscribe, and take advantage of what's waiting there for you.
You're listening to Stand to Reason, and Greg Kokel, the host here. By the way, tomorrow morning I get on an airplane and I fly to Mount Vernon, Ohio. I'll be speaking there at Nazarene University, the Mount Vernon Nazarene University. I don't have my paperwork in front of me. I'm not sure what I'm talking about, but I'm looking forward to it. So if you're within striking distance, you might go to our website, take a look at the details there at the page where my schedule's at. So tomorrow, and that would be Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I think Thursday is when I actually speak, and I travel on Wednesday and Friday. All right, let's go to our callers, and here we've got Shannon in Ohio somewhere, and glad you called, Shannon.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to talk to you, Mr. Kokel.
Thank you. And it sounds like you went, from what I see here, you were at Rethink?
Yes, I was at Rethink, and I was able to meet you during the question and answer series.
Oh, well, that's great. That's fabulous. Are you a student?
I am an adult. We brought a teen from our church with us.
Okay. I wasn't sure. You've got that kind of youthful voice there, so I wasn't sure if you're a mom. If I went with, like, if you're an adult, then maybe the student would feel offended, but I figured it's better to err on this direction. In any event, so that was a long haul from Ohio to Southern California.
That was a long trip. Our church asked if we would like to go out. We're planning a apologetics event for our youth this fall, and they said, would you like to go out and learn? And I've been a longtime student of yours, and I was very excited to meet you.
Wow. Wow, that's great. And how many students did you bring with?
We brought one.
Okay.
Because that was a lot to go out there.
I know it was. That's why when you said something like that, I thought, well, that would be a pretty big nut to crack financially. So,
yeah.
So it was you and the student, and were there any other adults?
And my husband.
Okay.
And we just learned so much. We had a fabulous time. Everything was very well done, and I would highly recommend it.
Wow. Thank you. Well, what stood out for you? What part did you like the best about Rethink?
Boy, there was so much information that was so just easily accessible, easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Dr. Christopher Yuan?
Yuan. Christopher Yuan, right.
His testimony, I don't think I've heard his name on your show maybe before. I hadn't heard of him before. His testimony was fabulous.
It was. Riveting is the way I described it. I was actually in the green room getting ready for one of my own presentations, and I don't usually hide in the green room, you know. I usually like to mix it up with people, be in the gallery, sit in the front row, benefit from all the talks, that kind of thing. But I just had to get some work done. And frankly, we have a big screen TV there, and I couldn't, I couldn't get my work done. I had to listen to what he had to say. It was so engaging, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was very much. Took lots of notes and just super excited to bring it back home to our church and the community.
Well, I guess the book that he's written that tells his story that was written with his mom and him is really fabulous. I actually asked him if he would send me a copy because we might have him on the air. I worked with him, with Christopher, in July, I think, in Tennessee with Summit. Summit had him speak and me as well. And I came in the middle of his presentation and then had a Q&A after my presentation. So I didn't know the whole background, and I was getting little bits and pieces as we're doing the Q&A. You know, he's sitting right next to me on the stage. But to hear the whole presentation was just unbelievable. And I hope that people will grab his book. His last name is spelled Y-U-A-N. Can't remember the title, but Christopher Yuan, and the book he wrote with his mom about his own journey. And I heard it. I actually talked to some friends of mine that said they could not put it down, and I'm not surprised.
Yes. Yep. He was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What'd you think of Jay Warner's final charge there, the one I was just talking about?
That was the other one that I was going to bring up. That was great. Our team said, well, of course they saved the best for last. And our team really connected with Jay Warner Wallace.
Yeah.
And just fabulous. Just really hit home their, you know, grand slam at the end.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Frankly, for my money and time, I would rather listen to Jay Warner Wallace than anyone else. He's just fabulous. And I'll tell you a story. He just told me this. I might have mentioned it on the air, but he told me about 2 years ago this. I didn't know it. I've known him for quite a number of years. But he told me that he started listening to this radio program when he was still an atheist.
Really?
And so this has had a role in his life. And the irony is, of course, he fills in for me now on occasion when I'm gone, and he does a superb job. And for him to be sitting here doing the thing to God's glory when he was still an atheist before, you know, thinking about, well, God has a sense of humor, you know.
Yeah, full circle
is right. Well, look at Shannon. Thanks so much for the call and for the kudos for Rethink. I thought it was a great weekend as well, and we look forward to more just like it.
Well, thank you, and Sandy Redison does excellent work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and if there's any way we can help you in the future, you know, way out there in Ohio, I know you got an event coming up in the fall for your students. Is that going to be? Are you doing something locally with the students there in your church? Is that it coming up in a month or two?
Yes, our church and community. We'll reach out to the community.
Dynamite, absolutely dynamite. Okay, good work. Keep up the good work there. Okay.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you, Shannon. Boy, that's really great to hear. Fabulous. All right, let's go to Montana. And this is Tom. Tom in Montana, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, great.
Hey. Or I should say howdy. What's on your mind, Tom?
Well, I I wanted to share a conversation I had had with a friend of mine. I work in a public school. I've had a number of positions there. I've been a teacher, elementary teacher, and now I'm a maintenance person, a custodian.
Uh-huh.
And
have we talked before? This sounds a little familiar. Have we talked before?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, the school principal has a science background. He was a science teacher in high school. That was my strong field.
Uh-huh.
When I was in college. And I'm not as articulate. Boy, I hear so many of your guests on here, and it's rather nerve. Makes me a little nervous trying to talk or articulate what I want to say.
Yeah, we're doing a good job so far.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Tom.
I ended up having this conversation with him about evolution and intelligent design, and I want to, and I even told him too. When we were talking, I said I'd revisit an area that he said something, and I'd say I just don't want to misrepresent you. I mm-hmm. want to make sure I understand, and taking some of your tips, and
sure.
some of your CDs,
coming to the tactical maneuvering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. trying.
Yeah,
and
good.
He said he claimed to be more of a theistic evolutionist.
Okay.
And he claims that God started the ball rolling.
Hmm.
When it gets to more of the things like the theory of evolution, he said he felt that everything was fine in that. He tried to...
You mean he didn't find any difficulty with the concept of Darwinian evolution with regards to his Christian convictions? Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And... he tried to explain or offer an analogy to me because I told him I believed in microevolution
uh-huh.
based on the evidence.
Right.
And I couldn't see macro so much because nothing has been, thoroughly demonstrated.
Uh-huh.
And he offered this analogy of there's a town, a distant town here that he said, if you walk from here to there, we tried to retrace your steps, we probably wouldn't see all of your steps. But does that exclude that, or does that mean that you didn't make the trip?
Right.
Just based on those certain things you didn't see. And I said, I don't see it that way. I mean, I would, if I saw enough steps, in court, circumstantial evidence.
Right.
I mean, if it was that way, but I said in macroevolution, they've taken a series of drawings and placed them next to each other. There's
mm-hmm.
there's still nothing that has demonstrated, and I mentioned, the transitional fossils and
right.
where are the pieces in between, and
uh-huh.
there should be millions of those fossils. And
right.
His response was that he thinks that, I think he was referring to me in my explanation that science gets oversimplified, evolution gets a bad rap for that.
It was oversimplified, did you say?
Yeah, that's the way he referred it it.
Huh. Well, I think of this analogy, and here's the deal with an analogy, and you probably know this for the other listeners. All an analogy is a sophisticated kind of illustration or assertion, okay? Analogies are not evidence. They are just meant for you to look at the same thing from a little different perspective, and if the analogy is properly parallel to the thing that you're talking about, then you might have an insight, okay? The mm-hmm. question about analogies is whether or not they're actually properly parallel. Right? Okay. So is it? Yes, of course it's the case that, you can have footsteps along a trail and some of the footsteps can be washed away, but that doesn't mean you didn't make the trip. Sure. But what if the footsteps are on one continent and then there's more footsteps on the other side of a big giant ravine? Well, probably the footsteps that led to the edge of the ravine are not the same of the same person that we see walking on the other side of the ravine, because there's a serious obstacle to getting across, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got another illustration. It's a competing illustration. And the question is whether his illustration captures more the facts than my illustration. And I think my illustration is more accurate to the actual facts, because it isn't just a matter of having a few footsteps washed away. It seems like there are big, giant canyons that separate the footsteps, if you will. And even if one set of footsteps look like the other set of footsteps, you still got this intractable problem of this huge canyon in the way. Then you can't just paper over that, you know, as if like this is no big deal, because it is a big deal. And incidentally, even a person's meandering through along the path has a beginning point. You got to start your walk before you can have a walk. So what is the start of the walk for the Darwinian? It's the origin of life from non-life without any help from God. You start with dead stuff, and then you get living stuff. But how does that happen? Nobody has any idea how that can actually happen. That is, every proposed solution is so fraught with difficulty that the other evolutionists shoot it down. So if you, I use the illustration of a football game. If you don't have a kickoff, you don't have a game. So notice how his illustration makes a lot of assumptions. It minimizes the difficulty. Oh, there's a couple of footprints maybe washed away. And also it presumes a starting point, but there's no starting point in Darwinian evolution. Not in fact. None of that's been demonstrated. There is in theory. Oh, yeah, you got to get life from non-life. Yeah, well, how do you do that? Nobody knows. Well, if you don't know how it happened, how do you know that it happened? Because evolution is a how. You got to have the how before you have the that,
right,
kind of thing. So, I mean, I think that his rejoinder to you is okay, interesting. It may sound good to him, but notice how it makes certain assumptions about the nature of the evidence. And I think your response to him was good. It ain't that simple when you look at the facts of the matter. I mean, he says, I think God started it all. Well, we can agree with that one. In the beginning, God, right?
Yeah.
So he started it all. But then the question is, what did God do to use evolution? Did he use that phrase, God used evolution?
I don't remember him saying that exactly. But, you know, all I remember him saying, and I noted it when he did, was that God started the ball rolling.
Yeah, well, but that's not controversial. He did start the ball rolling. The question is, with any ball that God starts rolling, how can it it result on its own power in increasing complexity over time? And not just increasing complexity. It would have to, God starts the ball rolling, and then on its own power, you'd have to get life, because he didn't say that God created life initially. He just said God got the ball rolling, and maybe he meant that. I don't know. But how do you get life from that kind of rolling process? And then how do you get complexity, biological complexity? How do you get consciousness from that rolling ball? And those are all serious problems that he's got to address in some detail. It's not enough to say, well, God just got the ball rolling. What if the ball was rolling uphill? Right? How's it keep going uphill on its own power?
He offered something else too, Greg, that I think he was using it as part of his explanation to me about his belief system. Is that, you know, he talked about, you know, and I mentioned that it was the theory of evolution.
Yeah.
Not the fact of evolution. And he said, we compared it to something like, well, there's the theory of gravity. You believe in gravity? He said, all the theory means is that it's just not been proven wrong.
Well, First of all, I do not think that is a precise definition of theory from a scientific perspective. Sometimes you can use the word theory, as in one is theorizing about how something took place, and there it's a very weak definition in a sense of like it doesn't really say much about it. It just said that here's an idea that we're putting in play. Other times you can have a theory. And what the word theory is being used there as is a synonym for the word law, which is a very, very well-established, profoundly solid notion in the scientific realm. And then you would, yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody talks about the theory of gravity. It's more like the law of gravity, you know, because it's universal and there are no observed exceptions to this, you know, just like the first law of thermodynamics and the second law of thermodynamics. These are principles in play that we don't see any exceptions to. But the problem with the Darwinian model is it's not a law. It's a theory in that it is open to question in principle, and there's a whole lot of people that have no religious axe to grind that are questioning it because it's, like I said, well, how do you get the theory that's absolutely true if you have no kickoff? Where are you going to get a origin of life based on evolution? You're not going to get it. It's an intractable problem, and it isn't because we just don't know enough. The more we know, the more difficult the problem becomes. So I think that he is just using, you know, language on his side, so to speak. He's using the ambiguity or the way that the word theory might be used as a synonym for law, and then is applying that to evolution, such that evolution is only a theory in the sense that gravity is a theory, that they are both on equally solid footing, and this is not true. If that were the case, and there are a lot of people who say, you know, that of course it's fact, and we all know it's fact, but this isn't what's going on. And this is the popular world talks like this, or evolutionists when they're talking to critics like design folk, they'll talk like that. But when they're talking amongst themselves and they're writing their papers and they're in the journals and all that, there are all kinds of problems that they see with the Darwinian model and which they mention. So anyway, I got to go to break, Tom, but I hope that helps a little bit. It sounds like to me like you did a good job in your conversation with your principal, even though you're a maintenance man. Did a great job. Good for you, Tom.
Thank you, Greg.
Yes, you're welcome. Okay. Let's go to break, and we'll be back in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
There's always something new for you on the str.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Alan, and Tim, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts each week, new featured resources each month, and news about upcoming events. So take a few moments to browse the str.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at str.org.
Greg Kokel, one of the good guys, giving you a piece of my mind this week, as I do every Tuesday night from 4 until 6 on our podcast radio show. Some of it gets to radio. It's all available in podcast. And if you want to call me, you can do so, 855-243-9975. You just have to call during those times, Pacific time, here in Los Angeles. All right, let's go to Kate. Hello, Kate. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, thank you.
Sure. What's on your mind? In Texas, no less. We get
yes, sir.
We're getting states today instead of cities. But glad to have you on board, Kate.
Oh, thank you.
So, what's on your mind today?
I had a question. In Bible study, I've heard people a lot of times talk about loving unconditionally, and it brought up the question, just like, is it, are humans capable of loving unconditionally? And then that led to, does God love unconditionally?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been blue letter Bible searching things. I'm just interested in your input on that. I've kind of come to some conclusions, maybe, or thoughts myself, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think this is one of the things that Christians say fairly regularly, unconditional love, God loves unconditionally, we should love unconditionally, but they don't qualify it at all. And I think this is one concept that would be well for us to be more careful about, okay,
mm-hmm.
because it can be misunderstood. God does love in virtue of, he does love human beings, us, after a fashion, or let's put it this way, there is a love that is not conditioned on anything. That is God's love for his created order and for the world that he made and for the humans that he made in his image. There's no condition on that. That is his love expressed towards humans that motivates his reaching out and providing a rescue plan, okay? But then mm-hmm. there's another kind of God's love that is conditioned. That means one must fulfill a condition in order to qualify for that love. Now, one might characterize God's redemptive love in that fashion. That is, that there is a love that God expresses through forgiveness, but that love in forgiveness is only given when we satisfy the condition of putting our faith in Jesus. And therefore, it is not unconditional. It is conditional upon our faith in Jesus. And one might argue, once we do that, then there is a security that the only condition for salvific love has been met, and therefore we are loved securely after that without any worry. We are in, so to speak, or we're in God's family. I was thinking about, and I'm not sure if I can find it, but in the Upper Room Discourse, that's where Jesus and John is talking with his disciples, and he says to them, I guess I don't have it marked in this Bible, but he says, anyone who follows me and honors me, then the Father will love him. So now there's a characterization of a type of love that is not unconditional. There's a condition that is set on it. And I can't find it. I should probably, during a break, look it up, because I've looked a couple of times for it, and then circle it in this Bible. So, but in any event, you find it in John 14, 15, or 16, somewhere in there. My Father will love him. It's interesting here. He says, "He who hates me hates my Father also." Of course, that's talking about us hating Jesus, but in any event, so I think that we have to be careful when we talk about unconditional love. Now, we are also called to love sacrificially, husbands of wives, okay, and we are to love the way Jesus loved, and that is sacrificially. I don't know, I mean, I have to think more about whether the phrase unconditional is always appropriate.
Well, that's exactly the thing that I came to. So I'm interested to hear you say that. A lot of what you said is kind of what I came to, but I was thinking exactly that I think unconditional love is misused or overused.
Yeah,
and that a better description would maybe be steadfast love or...
Yeah,
because that's in Scripture again and again.
Right, so. Right. Well, that might be a synonym for unconditional love because it's steadfast. It's always there. It's continuing regardless. That might be God's steadfast love. When it uses that phrase, it's talking about a steadfast love towards the people with whom he's made a covenant promise. So he has a covenant promise to the Jews. He has a covenant promise to Christians as well. And God is steadfast in his faithfulness to his covenant promise, which entails loving and caring for his own. Now, I was just thinking of relationships. I do think there are relationships in which we are to bring love and give love to. Even though there are hardships and trials and we don't feel right. I mean, loving our enemy, if we are told to love our enemy, that strikes me as clear a characterization of unconditional love that we can have, because there could be nothing the enemy does to merit our love for them, love properly understood. And I think Lewis does a good job in characterizing. He says that isn't feeling a certain way, that is acting a certain way. It is seeking that individual's good just as I seek my own good. I seek the good and well-being for myself, and we are to love others the way we love ourselves. And I would say that might be a case for unconditional love if we are showing positive regard or at least caring for even our enemies. Remember the Samaritan and the Jew. So the Samaritan cared for the Jew who was his enemy, but he showed him love in so doing. So I do think there in the Great Commandments there is a case that can be made for unconditional love, but that doesn't mean there isn't a place for correction or where we put down our foot regarding certain things or we draw some boundaries, etc. And that's a little bit more of a complicated thing. So I guess simply put, I think there is a sense in which we are to love unconditionally, but at the same time, I think that needs to be cashed out and worked through a little bit more carefully. So does that help, Kate?
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you so much.
All right. All the best to you, and I appreciate your call. Let's go to Chuck in Texas. I'm moving the buttons here real quickly. Hope we don't hang somebody up. Chuck, welcome to
Hi,
the
Greg.
Show. Hey.
Hey, I wanted to tell you about a situation. The university I work at offers professors the opportunity to have a group of students read a book, any book of the professor's choice.
Wow.
And then write a 800-word essay on whatever the professor asked them to.
Is it a secular school?
No, this is a Christian school.
Okay.
And it could be really any book you want. There's no oversight by the university, as long as it's not like pornography or something.
Yeah.
So I've chosen your book this semester. I read it over the summer. And
The Story of Reality.
The Story of Reality, yes. Uh-huh. And the reason I chose that is because I want them to leave this this little colloquium, they call it, with a firm understanding that the Bible is the best explanation of reality out there among all religions, and basically steel them against confusion in years to come.
Good. Excellent. The best explanation for the way things are.
So the reason I'm calling, when I do these different books that I've done, I usually do the first book of Lewis's Space Trilogy, which is a warning against scientism, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to find some essay
It's Out of the Silent Planet, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. I love that book. And in fact, the students love it, too, when I do it. But I try to develop some essay prompts that will force them to engage with the material, because when you have to do required reading like this, you know, you may or may not really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want these essay prompts to kind of force them to get into the meat of the material in a way that will stick with them for years to come. And so I got to say, at this point, I'm not inspired yet with this. And I wanted to know if you had any.
Well,
any
is the essay prompt meant to be in the form of a question so that they would work on answering this question in their little essay? And is that what it's meant to do?
It's free. It's open to whatever the professor wants.
Well, for example, I mean, just from what you said, one prompt might be, why is the book called The Story of Reality? What is the significance of calling it reality? And what problem is the book in that regard meant to overcome? Now, the first whole section, introductory section, is called reality. And so that's they would be using trading on information in that section, maybe answer that question. Okay. Here's another question. I think for me it's best to put it in the form of a question because then it gives them something to aim for, answering the question as they develop this essay. And or in the essay, they address the question, I guess is better. And how about this? What was the reason that Jesus had to die? Okay, and this is getting to the cross and the substitutionary atonement, that kind of thing. Why did Jesus have to die? And I'm getting, I want to get to the idea that the exchange or the trade. Get to the idea of the trade. What Jesus did for us, he took our sin, we take his righteousness, and that's the way. That's what grounds God's forgiveness of us. The reason God can forgive is because of what Jesus did, and what he did on the cross makes the trade possible. Okay, I might ask, the significance of four facts regarding the resurrection. What is the significance of using a four-fact approach? And the answer would be that here are four facts pertaining to the question of the resurrection, but no fact is supernatural. They're all natural. And these are all facts that most historians acknowledge, but they are facts that, taken in unison, lead to the conclusion that the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth is the best explanation for those facts. So what I'm giving you is the question and a kind of, here's the point I want them to get to. I want them to work through here, laying this out in the rationale. You can ask questions about the problem of evil, and I have a certain characterization of that in the book, and why there's evil in the world. So those are some ideas that you might want to offer, and maybe what is special about man? And what does man's specialness, how does it inform our lives, like our moral obligations to each other? It might inform the abortion issue, the end-of-life issues, might inform, whether we, if God made us, whether we have the right to do whatever we want with our own bodies. I mean, so those are some things that are in the book that they might want to direct their essay towards. Does that help a bit there, Chuck?
Oh, it does. Exactly. I like what you're saying. I'll explore these.
Okay, good. And get back with me. I go to one more caller before the hour, but get back to me and let me know how that all worked out. I'll be curious. Okay, Chuck?
Okay, will do.
Okay, thanks for the call. All right, Paul in San Antonio, Texas. Now we got a city in Texas. A lot of Texas callers here. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Yeah, hi, Greg.
Hi
there. Thanks for taking the call. I know you're at the end. I'll try to be brief. I actually did get a chance to see you about 7 or 8 years ago. You spoke at a classical Christian school where my kids went. It was a real pleasure to hear you speak.
Oh, was that Rob Sheldon's school?
Yeah.
Yeah, where Rob is the headmaster there. Well, that's great. That was great. Yeah. I'd like to go back there.
Yeah, you need to come back.
I like that.
I'll tell Rob to invite you back.
All right. So, question.
Yeah, let me state the question, and I'll give you a brief bit of context to it, but I'll let you be thinking about the question at the beginning. And the question is, in what way could I demonstrate to an unbeliever who does believe in God that their belief in God is not a belief in the one true God, and they have a need for a Savior? And so that's the question, and the context is I'm referring to a sibling of mine. I have an older sister, who's 60, and who has sort of subscribes to New Age mysticism thought, and has been a leader in a New Age church, if you want to call it a church, even. But was just diagnosed with 3 different forms of cancer in the last 2 months.
Oh, my goodness.
So, as you can imagine, my concern is less over her physical healing, but over her spiritual healing.
Yeah, of course.
And as she gets positive news from the doctor, like optimistic things, she says, well, thank you, God. God's looking out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, what God is that? And it's interesting where she will give credit to God in good things as they happen, and yet I know that if she were to be healed of the cancer, she might not want to pursue a savior, and yet,
right.
So I see the cancer as actually an opportunity for her to be confronted with eternity.
Okay,
and so,
sure. So let me jump in real quick. I got 2 minutes here, so let me quickly get in. And I think it's a good impulse to thank God. I think that's a good moving in the right direction, even though her precision about who God is in question. Okay. I also, ironically, I was thinking this through as you're talking because I knew the basic issue, and I was thinking of a medical metaphor, and the metaphor was: let's say you had cancer, and you believed that doctors could help, but if you don't go to the doctor, it doesn't do you any good, and if you don't go to the right doctor, it doesn't do you any good. And plus, the assessment of the disease has to be accurate before you can get the right doctor to do good with the disease. That was my metaphor. The irony is that this is the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way this plays out, and you're getting the short shrift here a little bit, I'm sorry, but the way this would play out in conversation is you believe in God. So, okay, good. That's good, but it doesn't get you anywhere. You've got to have an accurate understanding of who the real God is and what your problem is before God, that you can have that problem before God fixed, and that's the sin issue. And this is where Jesus comes in. I've said this before, but Jesus is God with a face. He's not just G-O-D. He's God with a face. There's substance there. There's content there. And the content is very specific regarding this question. What is the problem and what is the solution? And so if she's a New Ager, she's going to cherry pick things like, well, the spirit of the kingdom of God is within you and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We are the great I am. No, we aren't. My recommendation to a person like that is read Jesus for yourself. Read through the Gospel of John and see what Jesus says instead of just cherry-picking that. Again, that was really fast, Paul. I'm sorry that we had such a short amount of time here, but I hope it gives you something to work with. Maybe you can call back and we can talk about it in a little more detail next time around. All right, that's it for this hour, my friends. Wow, went fast. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.